This is Red Eyes Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. Good to have you all with us. Today we're going to talk with James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com. He joins us from Japan and we are going to discuss the big picture from a geopolitical and conspiratorial point of view and highlight areas such as the manipulation of the financial system, currencies, the banks and the bailouts. We talk about eugenics and the chemical castration of men that is ongoing with estrogen-mimicking chemicals. Have the depopulation agenda begun? We also tie in the GMO and pharmacological agenda that is being run by the psychopathic elite with the aid of the corporate media. Sounds like a lot of fun now, doesn't it? Well, as you know, we like to look at events and things that are unfolding in the world from many different perspectives. And it's not all about listening to things that you either agree with or that makes you feel good. Awareness and growth means looking at the darker aspects to life as well. And we need to see the dirt in order to be able to clean it up. All right, welcome to Red Eyes Radio, James Corbett. Nice to talk to you. How are you, James?
I'm doing very well, and just want to thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to be here. It's great talking to you today.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Absolutely. We had James Evan Pilato with us here about a week or so ago now, and we wanted to have both of you guys on at the same time, of course, because both of you do the same video reporting. We obviously spent some time talking about WikiLeaks with James as well, but I'm glad we managed to hook up with you now in hindsight here as well, and I'm looking forward to diving into some of the topics that we want to address here today.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too, and you're right, James Evan Pilato and I, he's with MediaMonarchy.com, I'm with CorbettReport.com, and we do New World Next Week, which is at NewWorldNextWeek.com, so that's a weekly video series, and yes, we've been doing that for over a year now.
Excellent. CorbettReport.com, of course. Before we kind of get into some of the topics that we want to address and talk about here today, maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about the website, when you started up, and what some of the ideas are behind it, James.
Well, I started the website in mid-2007, so it really involves a podcast. That was sort of the initial basis for the website, and also interviews, and then articles and videos kind of grew out of that. And I've been doing that now for, I guess, almost going on 4 years now. And the initial impetus for it came from just the information that I really started uncovering and discovering in 2006 was when I really started to get into this. And at that time, I was just blown away by the discrepancy between the type of information that I was receiving through all the other various types of media that I'd been, I guess, force-fed to one extent or another throughout my entire life, and the discrepancy between that and then this information that I was encountering on the internet. And it was just so great to me that I mean, I'm no media personality and I never intended to be one, but it just jarred me so much that I felt that I had to get this information out in whatever way I could. And that was the initial impetus to the for the website. And I've just been doing it ever since then. And it's grown to a greater extent than I could have ever imagined, but I'm just blown away by how far the Corbett Report has spread so far, and that's I think not a testament to myself or the work that I'm doing so much as a testament to what everyone out there is capable of doing if they engage in this type of work and just take the initiative to get out there and start to spread the information that they think is important.
Absolutely. And you're over in Japan as well, obviously, here, and do you feel that it gives you a somewhat different perspective as well? I mean, if we talk about, we can talk a little bit about some of the, you know, media, how that is over there as well. I don't know how well you speak the language or at all, but do you watch any of the news over there, James?
I do. I don't watch it extensively. My Japanese is passable. I can have sort of daily conversations, but I'm certainly not able to sustain, you know, deep political discourse in Japanese. So, right. So watching the news for me is more of a Japanese lesson than anything else. But they also have a bilingual service with the main broadcaster here, the national broadcaster, where I can watch in English as well. And I would have to say that the quality of news reporting just over here is well, I don't know if it's a quality issue or a cultural issue, but it's certainly quite different than what you would expect or what I would expect being Canadian from back in Canada or from the American media that we get in Canada. But on that note,
what is the difference?
I mean, it's very different.
How is it different? If you can just give us a hint of that.
Well, I guess probably a lot of people have seen on YouTube those types of those animated videos from Taiwan or whatever with animations of news events that everyone laughs at. Mm. Well, in the Japanese news here, they have the similarly ridiculous types of animations and things to describe events that you wouldn't think need them and that type of thing. I'm not necessarily to that degree or not that ridiculous, but still just a different style of reporting. And then what they choose to focus on here is just so different. In fact, I was talking to one of my Japanese friends recently, and he was remarking on how he was watching Japanese news versus he was also watching various world news at the time. And the difference was that in every world media outlet was talking about the WikiLeaks story, which of course was quite big, you know, last month and the month before. And in Japanese news, it was barely even mentioned. So, I mean, just the discrepancy between what's talked about in Japanese news and the way it's presented, it's quite a bit different. But
interesting.
That's why I don't tend to get my information from the Japanese media.
So what do you feel that you focus on something, you know, in particular international or world news, as you say, or are you still kind of also focused on the American continent, U.S., Canada news as well?
Well, I would say that my focus is generally on North America. Obviously, as a Canadian and someone who's grown up in that political climate, that's what I know best and feel best situated to talk about. But I do make a concerted and self-conscious effort to try to make my news reporting and the things I talk about sort of international in scope, because certainly a lot of the media that I use for picking up news stories and for really forming the basis of my work, it comes mostly from America and has an American bent to it and an American focus, which of course is perfectly fine. But I think there's a lack of media outlets from other places that are talking about this information in this way. So I'm trying to, in the best way I can, try to make it as international as possible and focusing on areas in Europe and Asia as well, if I can.
Absolutely. I would agree with you there as well. I feel I'm up in Scandinavia, obviously, but even looking at Europe as such as whole, I mean, we have a lot of different languages going on here. So I'm not, you know, privy to know what actually is going on, let's say, within France, if they chose to speak the French language or German. But I feel that there's it's kind of a lack of alternative media here as well, in one sense or another. It feels like it's broader and it's more widespread in the States and in Canada as well. And that's why I feel also maybe that's why a lot of the people around the world are looking at the American alternative media as a kind of it's a central hub right now anyway. That's how I view it, James.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I agree with your assessment. But I think it is definitely there is an alternative media movement that's flowering in a lot of different places right now, and I've encountered a lot of it in Ireland. Actually, there's a group of people with the Sovereign Independent who I think you've had on the program before.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've talked to them and Open Your Mind Radio in Ireland and Australia also. I've talked to several people out there and had some guests on my program from out there. So it's definitely flowering all around the world. And I think just as alternative media, we need to be hooking up with all of these different aspects and shining the light on different places where this truth and information is flowering.
Absolutely. Now we do have some things lined up here, obviously more specific of what we want to get into, but if we I guess zoom out a bit and look at either where we've been, it's up to you, James, in 2010, or where we potentially is heading here in 2011, what do you feel are some of the most pressing issues? Is there something specific that you want to look at or want to dive into more, or feel you know that you want to watch or keep an eye on, if I put it that way?
Well, I'm definitely very, very closely looking at the financial and economic system that's in place and what we can expect to see coming in the next few years, because I think absolutely everything ties into the economic outlook. And unfortunately, I think as most of your listeners will probably be aware, that is not a very positive outlook for anyone in the world right now. Obviously, we're going through a time of great economic destabilization, and any period of destabilization can potentially be good, because obviously it means that we can move into a different system and hopefully implement a system that we want. But of course, the converse of that is that it's also a chance for the oligarchy to consolidate their power even further. And as we know, unfortunately, the centralization of economic power has been the dominant theme of the last few centuries, really. And unfortunately, this is their greatest chance to really upend the system and bring in a system of complete worldwide control. And we see all sorts of aspects of that agenda coming in, from the cashless society to the idea of a world currency. And unfortunately, we're moving more and more in that direction. And unless enough people start to turn the tide and really begin to turn the focus towards alternative ways of bringing in an economy that could actually help the people, we are in dire financial straits, and will probably continue to be so, to be in that situation until we can really reverse that tide.
How quick do you think this will go? That depends on two things here, obviously. If they get free reins, if they can pretty much do what they want, it might go quicker, obviously. And the question is how many people potentially will stand in the way for this or break the process a little bit. But let's say if they were given free reins, they could do this how quickly they want. What do you think we're talking about in time of implementation or a reformation, if you will, of the economic system, either going over to a world, you know, one world currency or something like that? We're talking about years or decades here. What do you think, James?
That's an excellent question, and it's one that I not only ponder, but I frequently posit to my guests on my program, because I think it from my perspective, it's very difficult to say. Obviously there are the two different ways of implementing it, which would be one sort of a drawn out, long, lengthy process of just slowly putting us into a type of economic slide that would be very controllable, or the other one would, of course, be a short, sharp, horrible depression that would bring the world to the brink of panic and starvation, and then we would be ready for any type of change. And personally, I truly don't know which way it'll go. Certainly, it seems like a bit of a slow slide right now, but it could really change at a moment's notice. And I think it really depends on the American dollar and how quickly it loses its status as world reserve currency, which is obviously and manifestly already in the process of losing that status. So it's just a question of whether that the rug will be pulled out quickly or slowly. And I guess in the same way of a magician, you know, doing the trick with the tablecloth and trying to get the cloth out from under the plates. If you do it slowly, the plates are going to slide off and everything's going to crash and break on the floor. But if you do it very quickly, there might be a way of maintaining the plates on the table, which I would posit is the economic control and of the ultra wealthy. So again, I have absolutely no idea which way that's going to go. I frequently posit it to my guests, for example, Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster, who has pointed out on my show numerous times that if the powers that be continue with the quantitative easing way of basically stringing the American economy along, they can continue to do so for maybe up to two more years. But after that point, it just becomes almost inconceivable how they could continue to keep things moving sideways, which is really what's happening at the moment, and only because of the injection of just vast amounts of liquidity that is really only possible because, of course, as we know, the money is just created out of thin air by the private banksters.
That's correct. And I mean, that's obviously the situation we're in now, from our, you know, from many people who are into this, you know, the alternative media, as it were, understand that this is it's a created problem. This is just not something that accidentally happened in that sense. But what do you think that the immediate solution will be then that might be offered to us here? Do you think that they will go in stages, perhaps? Obviously, there's talk about the North American Union first, and also a common currency over there, much like we have over here starting to go in Europe. But that's is kind of semi falling apart or collapsing now. And that's why some people have speculated maybe that is going to be bypassed in one way or another. Do you see the same thing over in the North American continent? Are they going to bypass the Amero and go straight for the world currency here? What do you think, James?
I'm beginning to think that obviously before I was thinking that probably a North American currency, a regional currency might be the obvious way that they would go. But it certainly does seem that the way that the euro is collapsing, it almost seems like that jumping over that and directly into a system of behind the scenes de facto world currency might be in the cards. And we already see that to a certain extent with the way that the special drawing rights that are administered by the International Monetary Fund are being used as a type of de facto world currency that's being traded behind the scenes through the privately owned central banks of the countries without it really affecting us in the day-to-day level. We never see it in our economy, but there's already this international system of exchange that's taking place through a standardized currency of sorts. Mm-hmm. And I could see some system like that coming into place where we don't really see it and we don't understand it. We don't feel it's functioning on our day-to-day level, but which will be, integral to creating the infrastructure, which will be absolutely, perfectly and completely necessary for the bringing about of world government, which I think is really what we're talking about here. I mean, once you start to talk about international currency, it doesn't really make sense unless you put it in the context of an international political framework, which is obviously the world government, which unfortunately, I don't know what the programming has been like for Europeans, but for Canadians, it's been that world government is a wonderful thing and the United Nations will be a beautiful, wonderful organization to administer this loving world government that will take care of everyone. But I think as many people are beginning to discover, that's very much not the case. And unfortunately, the oligarchs are very much in control of any system or move towards world government, which is why obviously everything that I stand for is for the decentralization of power and control into more local levels.
We are being sold out incrementally over here, I guess, in one stage. I mean, we've just a few days ago, actually, right now up in Sweden, changed our constitution to be of a more pro-European favor, turning Sweden into a multicultural society that is going to favor the European cause more than the Swedish one. So for us here, it's been a kind of an incremental step. And once that step is accepted, then why won't we accept the next one? You know, it's going to be done that way over here anyway. Give us a little bit what you see some of the dangers in this emerging world governmental system is then in that sense. Let's say we have somebody listen to us from the outside and say, well, what's wrong with it? We can all get along here and that's great, right? We can stop wars and things. A world government is an excellent idea to combat some of these problems. But what would you say to counter that, James?
Well, I would say that throughout human history, we can clearly see that the centralization of power into one location and in the hands of a very few people will always lead to a very few people becoming unimaginably wealthy and having just incredibly vast control over the rest of that society. So we see that with the formation of nation state governments. Of course, we see corruption and oligarchy taking place in the centers of power on the nation state level. So obviously, Washington is famously a corrupt, den of thieves, and everyone knows that in America, and everyone has a sort of instinctual revulsion towards the fat cats in Washington and that sort of thing. Mm. But unfortunately, if we move towards a world government system, then the idea that there are the type of bulkheads that you'd find on a ship in order to stop leaks or something from taking down the whole ship. Well, that's the idea towards nation states versus a world government. If there's some sort of dictatorial power or oligarchical control over the system, well, if it's on a nation state level, then other nation states act as bulwarks against that. And there's still the possibility for people to find freedom elsewhere. But if there is a world governmental system, then unfortunately, there's really no way to escape that system if it becomes corrupt. And I think that's a pretty generous way of putting it, because I think it would be set up to be corrupt from the beginning. But even if we were being generous and saying it was being founded by perfectly honest, perfectly wonderful angels descended from heaven just to rain manna down on all of humanity, even if that was the case, the possibility that it could one day develop into tyranny would be enough to, I think, make us really think twice about ever instituting a system like that. And unfortunately, if you actually go and start to examine the writings of the people who were really lusting after this idea for at least the last century, you start to see the very dark undertones of the idea of a technocracy, which really has not been possible in previous centuries. Even the idea of a scientific dictatorship has not been possible until very recently, and all signs point towards such a technocracy being just an unimaginable system of complete and total control over every aspect of our lives. And now that there are such scientific advancements that have taken place, I think few people really, really have internalized what that means. I mean, to imagine a Hitler or a Mao or a Stalin with 21st century technology and the ability to implement that on a global scale, if that doesn't send chills down your spine, then I think you're not paying attention, really.
Absolutely. And what are some of these elements that you see of this technocracy? If we talk about some of the implementation, I mean, the surveillance thing is an obvious one that people can see right now if they go out, but under the current, maybe in the stages of development and so forth as well, what are some of the things you see emerging out of this and becoming part of that daily control of us as human beings, James?
It's such a vast topic that my mind really boggles even trying to encapsulate it, which is why I think I've so far done over 160 episodes of my podcast, and I think numerous, almost all of them touch on some aspect of this question, because it's just such a vast question of how are we being conditioned and manipulated into this type of system, and what does it mean? But I think there are some key aspects to it, and one of them to keep in mind is that in so many aspects, the war that we're facing is a war on consciousness and the war on our ability to resist the system. And one aspect of that in the technocratic sense is the idea of the panopticon, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners may be familiar with. But if not, it was a concept for a perfect prison that was invented in the 18th century by Jeremy Bentham. And basically, the panopticon was the idea of a prison in which there was a central tower that could look out and on a circular prison in which prisoners' cells could be looked into by the watchtower, but the prisoners in the cells could not look at the watchtower itself. It was in a central location. It was brightly lit, so they couldn't see inside it, but the watchtower could see inside the prison. And the idea of that prison was that the prisoners would know that they could be potentially being watched at any moment. And then, but they wouldn't know if the watch tower, the security guards were actually watching them. So they would eventually begin to internalize the idea that they were being watched and would act accordingly. That is, even if they weren't being watched, they would act as if they were, and they would start to govern themselves through that condition. And this was the idea of a perfect prison, because obviously it would be perfect if you could have a very few people actually watching the prisoners, but every single prisoner feels like he is being watched at all times. And I think it's not difficult to extrapolate how our total surveillance society that we're being turned into and conditioned to accept could be a version of that panopticon on a societal scale. And I think, obviously, I mean, we can look at the ways that Google, which has strong ties to, I mean, to put it lightly, to the NSA and the CIA, is this vast treasure trove of information on all of us that we're constantly entering into it every day if we're unfortunate enough to actually use Google. And that's just one aspect, obviously. I mean, there's CCTV everywhere. There's so many different aspects of the ways that we're being surveilled that we often don't even begin to question or think about. But it begins to create that sort of society where people feel like they're being watched at all times, and therefore will start to govern themselves, will start to actually control what they say or do because they might be being watched. And I think one example of that hit home very recently, obviously, with this Jared Lee Loeffner story and the shooting of Congresswoman Gifford. I heard recently on a different program someone calling in and saying, oh, well, I talk about currency on my website too, so maybe I should take my website down. I'm worried about maybe people will be equating me with this type of thing. And it's amazing for me to hear that, because I thought, well, people who are at least immersed in the alternative media would be able to understand what type of psyop this is. But it just goes to show how effective these types of psyops can be. And I think that's one of the main aspects of this technocratic societal control grid is the ways in which it's a psychological war that's being played on us to get us to police ourselves. Because a lot of the technology that they want to bring in to police us is quackery. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. They want to put in cameras in seats in the airplanes that will be watching and recording everyone's eye movements in order to try to find terrorists. Wink, wink. Of course, it has nothing to do with that. It's complete quackery. They want to have scanners that will eventually, you know, be able to tell, you know, terrorists in a crowd by the way they walk or the way they you know, move their eyes.
Right.
And it's going to be absolutely and total there's going to be no scientific basis to these types of technologies, but they'll just be able to say, oh, well, we think this guy's a terrorist, and they'll be able to pull him out of line. And people, unfortunately, if society continues to be conditioned in the way it's being conditioned, people will eventually accept that and go, well, he must have been a terrorist. They pulled him out. And we see this 1984 society, and there are, of course, the literary forewarnings that we've had from people like Huxley and Orwell that I think people really need to take to heart, because that is the type of society that was once envisioned as a nightmare, and unfortunately these days we're beginning to accept it as just a part of our reality, which is really the scariest part to me.
Double plus good. I mean, there are some conspiracy theorists that often are accused of being paranoid, but I would argue that the establishments are the people who are really paranoid when you think about some of these systems that they're building up. I mean, it feels to me that they're in a position like a mob or something like that, that they have to defend their own wicked behavior because they know that at any point, at any time, someone could come along and do the same thing towards them in one sense. So it's an incredible paranoia that I see from their part, they're afraid of human beings actually speaking up against their behavior. That's what I see in a way, James. But
that is exactly right. And that's exactly what's indicated in statements like from John D. Rockefeller when he said competition is a sin. He didn't mean it in the sense that I think some people might think he means that by saying that we should all get along and work together and be cooperative and hold hands and sing kumbaya, which is the way I think a normal human being would interpret that. But I think what that really indicates is that the upper, you know, oligarchs, the very top of the system, they think that competition is a sin, i.e. you can't compete against us. And if you try, we will ruthlessly quench any idea that you will have any opposition to us, which is exactly how John D. Rockefeller got to where he was and exactly how the robber barons of the 19th century got in their positions of power. And unfortunately, because they are they tend to be motivated by the ideology of eugenics, which says that they are at the top of the system because they are the most ruthless people on the planet, and they deserve to be in that position. Well, because of that ideology, they actually truly think that that gives them power over the rest of society. And we see that absolutely and manifestly spoken of in the writings of people like Charles Galton Darwin, who, of course, was a who was a product of not only Charles Darwin, but also his cousin Francis Galton, because the Darwins and the Galtons and the Wedgwoods and the Huxleys all had this vast interbreeding program going on for generations that was designed to try to create this perfect human hybrid. Because, of course, if eugenics is true, then that must mean that if you just keep intermarrying with the same wonderful, perfect genes, then you're going to produce a superhuman person. But anyways, one of the products of this failed inbreeding experiment was Charles Galton Darwin, who wrote a book called The Next Million Years, which sounds pretty ambitious and certainly is. But basically, his idea is that a species can't really change in the evolutionary sense for a million years. So we're pretty much stuck with human nature for the next million years unless we can actually start to alter human nature. And one of his arguments was that we should be trying to sterilize and effeminize men, because the young male warriors type that has become the alpha males of society, well, they are the threat to the system. They are the threat to the people who are in control.
That's right.
So, of course, they'll target those people. Anyone who will actually posit a true threat to the monopoly of control of the oligarchy is a threat and must be eliminated. So there's no doubt there's this constant paranoia, and there's been painstakingly crafted, scientifically constructed plans for generations about how to dumb down, weed out, eliminate, effeminize, and otherwise get rid of any idea that there will be opposition to their monopoly of control.
Yeah. And how much do you see play into that? I mean, we hear stories coming out about a certain type of chemicals. I think it's one sense pro-estrogen and things like that. Even bottled water had some kind of chemical in them that actually is, in some cases, this chemical can change the sexes of fish in rivers, in the ocean, and things like that as well. Do you believe that this is that's just a side effect, a stupid choice of unfortunately the wrong people who made this choice, or do you see that this is a planned a plan basically to put this into our water supply to encourage these type of altering chemicals, James?
Yeah, excellent question. And I think that goes absolutely to the heart of the eugenics agenda. And when you start to look into this, you start to be able to confirm for yourself. And I would, once again, at this point, really suggest, in fact, stress and urge that people do begin this research for themselves and really do take a look at these types of things that I'm about to say, because if you don't see it for yourself, you will not believe it. And I would not want someone to dismiss this because it's coming from me instead of from your own research. So please go and actually look this up. But if you look, for example, at bisphenol A, which you just mentioned, is one of these estrogen mimicking compounds, which has somehow ended up in not only the plastics, for example, in the plastics, water bottles and things that people have been using, but also it was used as on the lining of tin cans used for food products. It was used as a way of stopping the aluminum flavor or whatever from mulching into the food. It was used as a lining for that. It's used in the printer ink that we get on receipts. I mean, it's used in so many different facets of our lives that there'd basically be no way to avoid this chemical even if you wanted to. And so the question is, how did this end up getting used? And now we know that bisphenol A is an estrogen mimicking compound. We know that it has very real effects on the endocrine system. It's an endocrine disrupting compound, which basically will effeminize men, and it will give women breast cancer, and it's a horrible compound. And yeah, the question is, how did it end up getting into the plastics that we use? Because of all the different ways of making plastic, I mean, there are hundreds and thousands of different chemicals that could potentially be used to make plastics. So how did bisphenol A end up getting into so much of the plastics that we use?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because with that particular chemical, it was not something that was discovered after the fact that this was an estrogen mimicking compound. Because back in the 1930s, bisphenol A was actually considered and was tested as a possible estrogen mimicking compound that could be used for estrogen therapy for women to actually boost their estrogen. So, I mean, the fact that it was an estrogen mimicking compound was known decades before it actually started to filter into the plastics and basically every aspect of our lives. So, I mean, that's just one example of a chemical that that has been and is still to a certain extent being used to basically sterilize, effeminize, give people cancer, just unspeakable things that it's difficult for the average person to wrap their head around. I mean, yeah, I understand why so many people don't want to believe that there is a psychopathic oligarchical elite that will stop at nothing to kill and or maim their competition in any way possible. And I understand why people don't want to believe that. But unfortunately, when you start to look at it time and time again with compounds like bisphenol A or with fluoride in the water or with the anti-androgen chemicals that you mentioned that are now starting to turn male fish into female fish and just all of these unbelievable compounds that unfortunately time and time again have been knowingly and self-consciously added to our water or our food supply or various products that we use on a daily basis in order to have the effect that it is now having on us, with cancer going through the roof, with autism going through the roof, mm-hmm. with all sorts of things that are just really an unspeakable soft kill weapon is being deployed against us. I mean, we are under total biological warfare attack as we speak. And unfortunately, very few people are even aware of it, let alone understand that this is a coordinated agenda.
I also want to encourage people to basically go and look a little bit in the history books as well and look at how certain peoples and certain cultures have been eradicated from the history pages in that sense, who had strength and morality to speak up against this. And it seems to me as well, and this is an obvious question that comes along with this whole with this reasoning, James, and that has to do with how do they keep their agenda going throughout such a long history? Because again, this once you begin to look at this, you realize that wait a minute, this is not just the last 30, 40 years this has been going on. This is if not hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years even. And the question is, how do they keep their agenda going, and how is it that they manage to continuously bring in people of their own ilk, either through family bloodline connections or what have you, but they manage to keep it going? What's your theory, or what's your idea about that, James?
I guess there are really two different aspects to that question, and one of them is the question of how they keep the process going in a technical sense, and then the other is why do they keep it going, or what motivates them to do it. So on the first question, I would have to say that the foundation for the entire system that they use against us is the economic system, and their control over the economic system enables them to direct society in whatever way they wish to more or less an extent. I don't want to paint them as all-powerful rulers of reality, because certainly they are not. And I think it's the sickness of most tyrants that they truly begin to believe themselves to be masters of reality. But so to a certain extent, I wouldn't want to paint them as such. But certainly the control over the economic system is an incalculable tool that can be used to really sway society in whichever direction they wish. Mm-hmm. But I guess the question of why or how they're motivated to keep this going for generation after generation, well, that's another question entirely. And I think there is absolutely some type of religious aspect to this. I'm not sure if it is religion as you or I or most people would know it. I'm not sure what it is, but it certainly is propagated through the secret societies that have been around for centuries, as you point out. And that's a very important core part of the nucleus of what makes these groups function. And I think when people start to look into, for example, just the rituals of Skull and Bones and the types of bizarre things that that initiates have to go through, and then to really ponder what it means that so much of the intelligence community in the United States, for example, comes from Skull and Bones. I mean, Skull and Bones really founded the CIA in so many different ways. And then, of course, when you get Bonesman Bush running against Bonesman Kerry in 2004, and to really ponder what it means that all of these people have gone through these bizarre occult initiation rituals. And that's just one aspect of one of the societies through which this type of this agenda is being continued and propagated into the future generations. So there is there's a vast system in place, and what motivates that system or why it is, well, that's something that's I think probably too grand for me to answer, but it's a fascinating topic nonetheless.
It is. It's an ongoing one, and obviously I think that there's a lot of people trying to find that question. I personally always wondered if there, if these initiate, I would agree with you on that, that it's some kind of inner circle, if you will, in some regard. To me, it feels like they must get briefed in some regard, depending on their level in the compartmentalization, obviously. But if they're high up in that hierarchy, that they get briefed on what actually is going, or what the plan is, and how that has been unfolding throughout the centuries, and maybe they philosophically are prone to steer towards this way to begin with. Or maybe they're even, I wonder how much justification plays into this as well, meaning that if you show people the right statistics, if you show people the right data in terms of, where the world is going, overpopulation, yada, yada, you might be able to convince people that they are actually participating in something good along the way. That it's up to us now to manage the human race, and we have the moral responsibility to in some way try to steer this big ship of state in the right direction. And that's always been a possibility to me too, that they might actually believe that they are doing something good, but the bigger picture might even be withheld from them. What's your take on that, James?
I think that's right. I don't think that's even just a possibility. I take that as sort of being for granted. I tend to give my political opponents and people of different ideologies the benefit of the doubt, and I tend to think that the vast majority of humanity truly believes itself to be doing what they think is for the best for humanity, broadly defined. And I guess it's how you define humanity is maybe the crux of that issue. But I think most people do truly believe themselves to be doing the right thing and truly believe that they are doing something good in some sense. And just some people have a very, very distorted sense of what is good. And unfortunately, when people are motivated, for example, by an ideology, let's go back to it, to eugenics, where it the entire ideology states that if you are in power, it's because A, you are ruthless, and B, you deserve to be in power because you are ruthless. Mm. And that type of ideology means that the more ruthless you are, the more convinced you are that you are doing something good when you get rid of the useless eaters or whatever ideological framework you tend to use to frame the vast majority of humanity. Mm. And unfortunately, in that type of framework or that ideological mindset, people can be motivated to do the most unspeakable and disgusting things in the name of doing something great and wonderful and good for humanity, just like every tyrant in history has convinced themselves that the eradication of millions of people, the spilling of just unbelievable amounts of blood, has been for the greater good somehow. Yeah, yeah. And unfortunately, that's the scariest part. I mean, it's easy to think that these people are just evil people who want to do bad things, but it's much scarier to me that they truly believe themselves to be doing good things.
Exactly. That takes it into a whole different area, a whole different realm in that sense. And I mean, some of the crimes that are that have been perpetrated against humanity and they're now are unfolding, if we even look at some of the environmental damage that has been done. Another question that dovetails with this is obviously how do they avoid some of this themselves? Even to me, it seems like that they're not only participatory in the destruction, if you will, of humanity and what is human, but it must affect themselves in many cases as well. I mean, we talked about the chemicals before. That's things that it's okay, you can still, avoid some of this if you're aware of it. You can stay away from it. You can do this on your choices. But other certain things that are happening in our environments is not that easy to stay away from. So how do you think that ties into it, James? How are they able to do this? Or maybe are they in the process of even taking themselves out in this as well? What do you think?
Well, it looks like that from our perspective, and it's highly speculative. There's not a lot to go on, but I would imagine that at the very top, again, it works on compartmentalization, as you pointed to earlier. So I think there are different levels of the players involved, and I'm sure people are told different things at different levels about the way they are. But it always strikes me, for instance, when I watch congressional testimony or something, and I watch these senators and congressmen and others sitting there with their Diet Coke in front of them, and yeah. Just to me, it's just mind-boggling to me that people at that level wouldn't understand about aspartame and what that was all about and how Donald Rumsfeld brought about this horrific biological warfare weapon on the American populace, and yet it's being consumed by people who a lot of people would think are near the top of the power pyramid but clearly aren't.
Yeah.
So I think there's a degree to which compartmentalization keeps even people who are in positions of relative power from actually knowing what's actually killing them. But I assume that at the higher levels, there must be different safeguards towards this type of thing. And certainly we do get glimpses of that. We do know, for example, that Prince Charles, whenever he travels anywhere, and of course, he's the one who's telling us that we shouldn't take hot baths or have electric lights in our homes because it's going to ruin the world.
Right,
but
right.
He, of course, has his multiple homes and flies all over the world in his private jets and
yep.
Has his entourage follow after him. And he will only eat foods, because everyone knows he's into organic gardening and the like, and he will only eat foods that come from his organic gardens and only eat meat that has been specially prepared by his his own entourage. So, I mean, there's definitely the indication that these people at a certain level are not eating the same foods that you and I are eating and are not exposed to the same chemicals that you and I are exposed to on a daily basis. And I think there must be something to that. And one of the most fascinating aspects of that for me was the Arctic seed vault in Svalbard.
Yes.
And there's just an incredible article that F. William Engdahl wrote a few years ago, and it was posted on globalresearch.ca and other websites about the Arctic doomsday seed vault. And it's just incredible the connections there between people like the Rockefellers and the government of Norway and Bill Gates and people like this who are coming together to create this seed vault where they will be storing the genetic heirloom seeds, that the non-genetically engineered crops, because as we know, there is absolutely no doubt that genetically engineered crops are being used as a biowarfare weapon.
Yep.
And unfortunately, it's taking hold. And once it gets into the biosphere, there's no way of putting that back in the box. I mean, that's the type of thing where I think the elite must be aware at a certain level that they are engineering this entire planet to fail, which is just mind-boggling. But unfortunately, it seems to be the truth.
Absolutely. Syngenta, Monsanto, some of these other corporations as well are involved in this process. And again, we're back to that question: how the heck are they going to avoid this themselves in that sense? And I've talked with other guests here, so like Richard Sauter, obviously. We've talked about some of the underground bases that potentially exists in various parts of the world as a probable scenario when it comes to maybe wrecking the whole biosphere in that sense, when it comes to the food production on the surface, at least in that sense. And then they have these incredibly genetic diverse seeds, obviously, as you say, stored up away up in Svalbard, which might be as kind of like the survival arc of humanity when things have gone terribly wrong on the surface, and maybe the population had been decimated or something like that. It's like a sci-fi movie almost, isn't it, James?
That's a very apt analogy, and especially when you consider the predictive programming that we've been under societally for so long to accept the idea that not only is there some sort of coming catastrophe which will force everyone, will kill vast percentage of humanity, but also there's been a lot of programming in a lot of different movies about how there will be a certain few who will be specially selected to survive, and they will survive by going in the Ark or going underground or going onto some space base or whatever it may be. And I've seen this in numerous different movies, but it is interesting to look at that type of predictive programming. So I mean, it's all speculative for me. I don't really have any facts on that, but it certainly would not surprise me in the least if there is some sort of evacuation plan for the people who are at the top of the pyramid. And I'm sure that a lot of people who are in positions to wield some amount of power are told that they will be part of the Ark or whatever passes for that. But I'm sure, as always, they'll be backstabbed, and there will be a lot of people who think that they're the chosen ones who will in fact be slaughtered as well. So
and that seems to be happening as well, actually, as we speak as well. People are picked off here and there. Who was the latest one? I'm gonna try to dig this out. Maybe you recall this right away, James. It was someone kind of higher up, top level, who were talking. Actually, one thing he was mentioning about this latest the birds that were killed in Arkansas over Beebe.
Yes, I know who you're talking about. The name escapes me at the moment, but it was a high level a former Bush aide who did have some access to that type of information. But for the life of me, I can't remember his name at the moment. But I do know what you're talking about, and he ended up in a landfill recently.
Right. Yeah.
He was wandering around like a lunatic with one shoe and basically disoriented and blabbering to himself for the last couple of days of his life, and then ended up in a landfill. And no one exactly knows what on earth was going on there, but it's definitely some bizarre things happening. And that just plays into the pattern that we've seen over the last decade or even more now of people in top-level biological scientists and top-level positions in various fields researching bioweapons and that type of thing, who are mysteriously ending up dead in just incredibly bizarre ways. And we've seen that documented by a number of people now, and there's been hundreds of such murders and deaths and suicides and bizarre deaths going on for over a decade now. And unfortunately, it all seems to point in the direction of some type of massive biological weapon, which could be being prepared, and the people who are preparing it are being eliminated. But again, that's complete speculation, but it seems to be in line with the facts as we know them at any rate.
Exactly. We're just trying to connect some of the dots and see in one way or another what potentially is on the horizon. Doesn't mean that it's an encouragement that people should panic and go bonkers. But in any regard, John P. Wheeler III was his name there. And he worked part-time for the defense contract MITRE Corporation. And just as I said, he ended up in a landfill here around New Year's or shortly after. We have the hundreds of microbiologists, as you kind of alluded to as well, being dead or taken out in one way or another throughout. Well, this has been ongoing for many, many years now, actually. And that's another kind of strange lead that kind of so far has led nowhere except, as you say, suggest, James, more speculation and more possibility that this is some kind of biological weapon is unfolding. But let's continue on the speculation route a little bit more here before we begin to round things up here for the first hour. And just ask, what do you see, how do you see this playing out then? Are we talking about very near future potential events here? Are we talking a couple of years ahead in the future? Or again, are we looking at decades ahead? What do you think?
I would be very surprised if we were looking at the near future. I would tend to assume that, like most of the major changes in our society, this will be used, brought about through a process of incrementalization, incremental implementation, whereby we get used to it bit by bit. So I would assume that there will be small bioweapon releases followed by larger and larger ones until eventually it's sort of taken as a given that these types of mysterious plagues and illnesses will just sweep through and eliminate vast hordes of people. And I'm sure it'll be presented to us either as some sort of bioterrorist group who is, you know, shadowy and no one can ever find the leader and that type of thing, or it will be presented as some sort of naturally occurring phenomenon. But either way, I think people would be brought about to eventually accept that this is just going to happen. And unfortunately, I think that's the way that the system tends to work, is to try to make us accept what's happening to us. So I would be extremely surprised if they started with large scale hard kill weapons all at once. I would assume that it would be very slow and incremental. And I think to a certain extent, maybe we've already seen that. I mean, we've already seen various panics over bird flu. And then, of course, we saw the great swine flu that didn't occur last year, which was, to me, it seemed a very convenient way of setting up a lot of the infrastructure for these types of biowarfare panics, at any rate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we might be looking at things that are not as severe yet in that sense, but further down the road, we might actually see something that, because again, these cases of swine flu, bird flu, what have you, the people that are allegedly dying of this is less than people are dying from the, was it common cold or something like that?
And that's right. Yeah.
Nothing,
the average,
nothing.
Right. The average year, more people die of flu than died of the swine flu last year. So, why was all the hype? What was the hype all about? And to a certain extent, it traced back to the fact that that flu was related to the 1918 influenza epidemic, which of course killed so many people after the First World War. And we know that in the last decade, the U.S. Department of Defense hired researchers to go out to I believe Alaska to dig people out of the permafrost in order to isolate the frozen remnants of the 1918 Spanish flu. And that's just bizarre and scary all in and of itself, the fact that the U.S. Army was interested in isolating and capturing this pathogen, which it just created unspeakable carnage throughout the world in early 1900s.
Yeah, more justification, I think. If we don't do it, someone else will, and therefore we have to have our hands on it. Who knows? But I think, James, this is a good time here to begin to wrap things up here for the first hour. There's so many points more I want to discuss with you and talk about. This is a very interesting conversation. Really appreciate you being here with us, obviously. But let's talk a little bit more about your website before we wrap things up here. CorbettReport.com, that's the main hub where people can find the majority of the material that you do have out there. You also have some DVDs, obviously, out there as well. You graciously sent us one. I really enjoyed it. It's your video reports. Tell us a little bit about the DVDs and things you have out there as well, James.
Right. I just released the 2009 Video Archive DVDs, which is just a collection of some of the most important interviews and videos, footage that I put together in 2009. It's about, it's over 90 minutes of footage, and a lot of it has not been seen before, interviews that I had not released on my YouTube or anything of that sort. And some of them have been released before on my YouTube, but I thought were important to preserve. So it's is available for purchase from CorbettReport.com. And as we're recording this, right now, I'm behind the scenes. I've just put up my newly redesigned CorbettReport.com, and I'm about to redirect the domain over to it. So hopefully in the next few days, it will start to filter out. So probably by the time people are listening to this, unless something catastrophic happens, there should be the newly redesigned site, which will look a lot nicer and be easier to navigate. But at any rate, people can go there to find my episodes, interviews, articles, and videos. And I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of media up there for people to start dipping into.
Excellent. CorbettReport.com, and heads up on that new design as well. Always nice with a facelift as well. So excellent. Stay with us, James. We'll talk more here after a little break. Proceed with a second hour together with James Corbett. We continue to talk about transhumanism, new technology, eugenics, James' coverage of the climate gate issue, the fraud of global warming, and the economic situation. To listen to the second hour, you need to have a membership to redicecreations.com. Since we don't have commercials, sponsors, or primarily encourage donations, this is how we can continue doing what we do and offer the majority of what we do for free. So if you appreciate the work, like what we do, and want to hear more of this or any of our previous programs, please consider signing up for a 3-month subscription with us. Go to our website, there you can read more about how to go about doing this. Thank you for joining us for the first hour, but we'll be right back with hour 2.